Doomsday is almost here.
December 21st, 2012.
The final battle of good versus evil.
Some say it is happening now.
I honestly don't know what's going to happen in 2012.
Or is it all just coincidence?
We're feeling this time coming on.
Stay alive. We're coming to you live.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
Bringing you the future.
Our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world.
I was never satisfied.
I'm going to send us here. Do you have a class at 2 o'clock?
It's all too
small. I'm not happy about 1:30 to 2 o'clock. It's very bright. That's the same because it's the same color.
I don't want to imagine hearing a very large weapon.
Does anyone here would recognize civic virtue if it reached up and bit you in the ass?
And now, Dark Matters. Here's Don Ecker.
Another brand new week of Dark Matters Radio. I'll tell you what, I'll be your host. My name is Don Ecker. I'm in a small little studio somewhere in Southern California, where even though we are on the cusp of the fall equinox, it's still hotter than the hinges of Hades out here tonight, at least where I'm at. Boy, I'll tell you, tonight's show, I have crammed for this one, ladies and gentlemen. I have crammed. Look, I've been in this crazy paranormal field for quite a while, and most of it has been taken up with the fact that I was director of research for UFO Magazine with well over two decades of out there rooting around in that morass of research, which is called UFOs. And over those several decades, I've come across a lot of explanations of what this phenomena may be. Extraterrestrial technology, of course, seems to be the most prevalent explanation for a lot of these sightings. Certainly not all of them, but a lot. And then there are other things, from misidentifications of astronomical bodies, things like, outright lying and hoaxing, folks, hoaxed photographs, explanations of secret military technology, those types of things. But the one explanation that until recently I have given personally the shortest shrift to was one that I heard years ago from some religious fundamental people, and that was that this is a satanic deception. Now, if you've taken the time or if you've been sitting around with spare time in your hands and you tuned in on your television to folks like Pat Robertson and the 700 Club, he was quite dramatic about his pronouncement that he felt that UFOs were satanic. But other than fundamentalist, is there anybody else that may subscribe to that theory? Well, if you've been tuning in to Dark Matters Radio's last number of months, you'll have heard shows that I did with folks like Chris O'Brien, Phil Imbrogno, and also tonight's guest, Mr. Nick Redfern, where we've talked about the possibilities of interdimensional incursions from some other reality. Well, recently, Nick Redfern's brand new book was released. His publisher, and I'm very grateful for this, was forthcoming in sending me a copy of the book a few days ago, and I finished it. I read it from cover to cover. The title of the book, Final Events, and the Secret Government Group on Demonic UFOs in the Afterlife. Now, just the title is somewhat provocative. A secret government group? Well, that's what appears to be behind this. And Nick, through some rooting around for a number of years, finally came up with this incredible story. And I got to tell you, this book made me uncomfortable when I read it, much like when I read John Keel's Mothman Prophecies over 30 years ago, or some of Vallée's work. This is an uncomfortable read. What makes me uncomfortable? Well, the fact that any or parts of it could be possibly real? Well, we're going to find out. Without a lot of further ado, I'm going to bring Nick on. Nick, once again, thank you for joining us on Dark Matters Radio, and by golly, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Don. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You bet. Okay, let's get cracking on this, Nick. Final Events. Now, does this kind of tie in with some of your other works that you've been pumping out for the last few years? I mean, you had to know that when you finished putting the last word down on paper, or probably more specifically your computer screen, that you were gonna ruffle a lot of feathers out there.
Well, yeah, I mean that there's no doubt about that, Don, at all. I mean, that certainly wasn't my intention. The intention was to bring to the attention of the UFO research community and people that might care to read the book several things. One being that as far as government investigations into UFOs are concerned, you know, things didn't begin and end with things like Grudge, Blue Book, the Robertson Panel, Sign, Project Twinkle. You know, these official projects that we know went on. So in other words, it was to demonstrate that other groups and think tank style organizations have looked at the subject, and also to demonstrate that they've come to different conclusions. Now, you know, as you rightly pointed out at the beginning, this is a subject that, for the most part, has been dealt with by fundamentalists. And, you know, I don't consider myself one of them. You know, I'm not somebody who even has a strong view one way or the other on life after death at all. And so, in that respect, it was kind of, I won't say difficult, but it was kind of one of the challenges was how to write the book. You know, do I insert myself into the story and constantly, you know, repeat to the reader, which would get very tiresome, saying this is just a theory and hypothetically speaking, etc., which would get repetitive, or do I just tell the story. And so that's what I elected to do, was to tell the story as it was related to me and put it out there for people to see. So in other words, it's not my... I'm not a mouthpiece, if you like, for this group. I'm just speaking about the aspects of the story that I uncovered and presenting it for people to see.
Well, one of the first things that the reader comes across at the very beginning of the book is a former MUFON official who also happens to be an Anglican priest, a gentleman by the name of Ray Boucher, who claims that a number of years ago he was approached basically out of the blue by a couple of people purportedly from the Department of Defense. Let's start there.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of these stories where, had it not been for Ray, I would never have actually got onto the trail of the story. I mean, a number of people have asked me since the book came out, well, how did you find the story out? Did you just stumble upon it, you know? And occasionally that does happen to people. I've never been unfortunately, I've never been in that position of, you know, just stumbling across a really great story. They usually take some digging. This one was a little bit different in the sense that I saw a chapter in a book about 10 or 12 years ago where there was a brief reference to the fact that Ray, who, as you just pointed out, is an Anglican priest, but he's also a former state director for the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON. He was a former state director for Nebraska, for the Nebraska chapter of MUFON. And Ray had been interested in UFOs since the 1960s and had come to the conclusion, as an Anglican priest might do, that the UFO phenomenon was very real, but he believed it was essentially not evidence that UFOs were visiting the Earth, but evidence of some sort of, like a literal battle between good and evil. You know, there are good forces and there are evil forces. And Ray was cited in a book chapter that I read a few years ago, just a brief reference to how he talks about, in 1991, in November of that year, having been visited by two Department of Defense scientists who told him that they wanted to meet to discuss something that would be of mutual interest and where possibly, you know, they could toss back ideas and so forth. And Ray was obviously intrigued, you know, to get a call from two Department of Defense physicists, not the sort of thing that happens every day, I'm sure. And so he agreed to a meeting at a place called the Cornsucker Hotel in Lincoln, Nebraska, and went out there, I guess, with no real, you know, idea of what might happen. When he got out there, and the story that developed over the course of two personal meetings and a couple of follow-up phone calls, or a number of follow-up phone calls and exchanges, things like that, the story he got was that there was like a clandestine group within the Department of Defense that was looking, almost like a follow-on from the whole remote viewing project, which was looking at the powers of the mind and how they could be exploited from a military perspective, along the lines of causing heart attacks and strokes, literally like a remote fashion, like a psychic assassination in simplistic terms. And one aspect of the project was essentially to try and contact what I suppose we would call, or most people who are interested in UFOs would call, aliens, or they would call the Greys, something, you know, whichever scenario you prefer. But this particular group called them NHEs, which supposedly stood for non-human entities. And according to these two scientists who spoke to Ray, they concluded initially, and as did most people on the project, that these entities were extraterrestrial. But the further they got into it, they said it was like a dark cloud descended on the project, and there was a lot of bad luck, even a number of deaths of people involved in certain experiments, which Ray was actually shown photographs of.
Yeah, no, let me pause you there for a second.
Sure.
Now, here he is, an Anglican priest, okay, a man of God, a man of the cloth, and I don't know Reverend Boucher, so I have no way of knowing what kind of fellow he is, but I would presume he has, just by the nature of his profession, a lot of empathy for the human condition. Now, here are these two alleged government physicists, scientists from the DOD talking about committing remotely viewed assassinations, those kind of things. I'm kind of shocked Boucher didn't get up and leave.
Well, you know, I mean, I think it is one of these situations where I guess if you put on the spot, it's difficult to, you know, analyze it right at that second when you're confronted by such a thing. You know, I think it's kind of like witnessing a car accident or something. You know, your mind doesn't necessarily always work the way it would in a wholly, I guess, not quote, normal scenario. And then afterwards you think, you know, I should have or could have done this better. Or
but you see what I say, what I'm saying there. I mean, you
Exactly. I know exactly what you mean. I just think sometimes, you know, when you're in a sort of a really surreal situation, that normality kind of goes out the window. And, you logic, I think that does happen sometimes, I mean.
By the way, Nick, did they show him proper DOD identification?
Yes. That was one of the things that that Ray insisted on, and that he clarified to me, that regardless of the validity or otherwise of the story, the people did hold the positions they claimed they held. And the story, the way the story developed was that there was a belief that these entities had the ability to sort of share their mind powers, I suppose, or teach us how to develop our own. But the scientists felt that actually, there was like deep deception at work along the lines of these entities, I guess, helping us because they wanted to deceive us into believing they were extraterrestrial, when in reality, pretty much the entire group came to believe they were quite literally demonic, and they had sort of a negative attitude towards the human race. And the idea was for them to get their claws into us, but to do so under an extraterrestrial deception. And they told him all sorts of things about how there'd been sort of black rituals and even allegedly human sacrifices undertaken on behalf of like the intelligence community that was involved in not just sort of looking at, for example, the technological side of this and how the brain could be developed, but consulting like 14th and 15th century books on how to conjure up demons and supposedly raise people, raise informants, wanted out of the project. They felt it was going down a path they didn't want to go.
One second, Nick. Another question I have, and this was never actually made clear in your book. Were these people working side by side, face to face with these entities?
No, actually, no. You bring a good point up there, because no, that was actually never made clear. But the implication I got, and the reason I got this implication, was from people speaking to people further down the line, that actually some of these contacts were supposedly undertaken in altered states of mind, when people were like either meditating or in some cases even under hallucinogenic drugs, and literally these, you know, these entities manifested before them, even though other people couldn't see them. We're talking about people being given DMT, which is a naturally occurring product in the body, but in large amounts can provoke what look like very, very realistic hallucinations. And many people report incidents where they sort of commune and have contact with very strange-looking entities. Even people placed under the influence of mescaline and different things, to where, in other words, they were believing that it wasn't like a physical creature was manifesting in the room. It was like they were meditating in a similar fashion to people used to do in the whole remote viewing project, but they would be rendered into such an altered state that they would see these entities and
have some sort of communication
with them.
Terrence McKenna also talked about that
in
some of his drug experiments. Now, one other thing.
Probably the closest way I could describe it as to how the contact was made is sort of along the lines of some of the experiments that McKenna and people like Rick Strassman have done.
Right. Now, one other thing, and I don't want to keep interrupting you, but I mean...
No, it's no problem. It is a complicated story, so if there's anything I haven't made clear, by all means, just, you know, say so.
Well, my mind is going incredibly fast with this stuff.
Yeah.
But you mentioned something about human sacrifice. Now,
Yes. Who
allegedly conducted the human sacrifice?
Well, again, we don't know exactly who, but the story that was given to Ray was that this was part of the overall project. And it actually sounds like this was quite a large project under which there were a number of, I guess, like umbrella. You know, it was an umbrella project and there were various sub-projects beneath it. And one of them was to try and utilize the mind powers. Another one was actually to try and, you know, to contact these entities. And according to Ray's people, develop some sort of crackpot Faustian pact with them to use their skills. Now, in some of the photographs that Ray was shown where people had died, he wondered where these people had come from. Who were they? Were they prisoners? You know, were they prisoners of war? Were they volunteers? But they'd all gone wrong in the sense that the people had died under pretty horrific circumstances. One through what looked like a remotely induced cardiac arrest. Another one that was a very weird description of somebody who had supposedly a weird crushing to their skull, which was actually done at a distance. You know, you're just looking at someone and suddenly the whole side of the head caves in. It was literally along those lines. And the people felt, race scientists felt that the project needed to be stopped and they should get out because the scientists, whether they believed it was extraterrestrial or demonic, were getting sort of seduced by the lure, which I guess was the, allegedly, if you believe all this, you know, the intent all along. And, you know, as I said, Ray had several meetings with them where it went along these lines and they spoke about things like Jack Parsons, who was a devotee of Aleister Crowley, being responsible for opening certain portals in the 1940s that let the UFO subject in en masse, so to speak. And things like this, and just very, very strange, you know, almost like Armageddon-like future scenarios, you know, that the end was looming near, and the UFO motif, if you like, was going to be the final, ultimate deception before the final battle between good and evil kicked off, you know, large scale.
Well, some of the names in this story are legendary. You just mentioned two of them. Aleister Crowley, the Beast. Mm-hmm. Who, incidentally, was one of your countrymen, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, yes.
I'm not sure
what that says about England, but yes, he was.
Jack Parsons, who was mm-hmm. one of the founders of Aerojet Corporation, yeah. as well as JPL.
Mm-hmm.
The nickname they used to use was Jack Parsons Laboratory.
That's right. I mean, a lot of people don't realize this. I mean, you know, when you look at people like Crowley, when I dug further into the group, you know, I realized why they came to the conclusions they came. Because, I mean, I knew quite a bit about Parsons and Crowley anyway. But, I mean, back in 1918, Crowley undertook, I guess, basically a series of workings, collectively known as the Amalantra working, which basically involved putting himself into an altered state via the ingestion of hashish and mescaline, essentially to achieve like an altered state of consciousness. And it was while he was in this altered state of consciousness that he allegedly was contacted by this so-called interdimensional entity known as LAM, L-A-M. And if you Google LAM, you know, on images and you see the picture of this being, it looks like, you know, the second cousin of the creature on the front of Communion.
Yes,
you know,
it does.
It's like a large-headed, bald-headed creature with little tiny shoulders.
A grey.
You know, it looks like a proto-alien. Well, Crowley, of course, at the time, you know, didn't talk about the greys or anything like this. We're talking about 1918, you know, nearly 30 years before even the term flying saucer was even coined. But Crowley had been involved in a number of things like this, trying to contact so-called, or conjure up so-called elementals and magical beings. But according to Crowley's own words, he recognized that, you know, you have to be careful when it comes to dabbling with these entities because they can be vicious, they can be friendly, they can be trickster-like, and they can be downright deadly. And, you know, there was the idea was that there are different tiers of entities, if you like, with different agendas. Now, of course, you know, this is all dependent on people who believe these theories. But then in the 1940s, you had Jack Parsons, who became a full-on, I guess, first like a fan of Crowley, and then a devotee of him. and to the point where they became, you know, pretty close comrades and friends. And Crowley actually chose Parsons to lead what became known as the Agape Lodge of the Thelemic Ordo Templi Orientis in California, after Crowley had essentially expelled the previous leader, a man named Wilfred Smith. And it was then that Parsons began dabbling into the sort of the same areas, trying to conjure up these entities. And this was sort of 46, 47. And the people Ray spoke to concluded that it was all this dabbling on the part of Parsons in the wake of Crowley conjuring up this grey-like alien being called Lamb, that opened the doors and just let these things in for the first time. It wasn't like that, because these groups actually concluded that these entities that we call aliens have been around in many forms for years, many forms of deception, everything from angels to djinns to goblins and all sorts of things. But they felt that the doorway was stretched to its widest point, thanks to Parsons, if you like. And in 47, you know, the UFO phenomenon came through the door and set the scene for, you know, whenever it's going to happen in their mind, the ultimate battle. So they put it all down to Crowley and Parsons as being responsible for everything from Kenneth Arnold and Roswell onwards.
Well, now, one of the things that was stressed in your book is that these entities, these creatures, whatever they are, seem to have feelings of great hatred and loathing for human beings. Was there any reason or explanation given for that?
Well, yeah, there actually was one reason, but it was more of an opinion, and I actually didn't include that in the book, because I talked about the theory anyway. Basically, what it came down to, I guess the most disturbing thing that the group concluded, and actually when I say the group, collectively it seems there may have been two or three different groups all following this similar path that may at some points in actually relatively recent years unify, but at some point there was at least two, possibly even three groups following this demonic agenda. But they all agreed on one very disturbing point. And granted, this was based upon interviews with people who'd had out-of-body experiences, and even a few clandestine, off-the-record meetings with members of the American public who claimed alien abduction experiences. And the group basically concluded that the reason why the aliens don't land, these entities don't land and say hello on the White House lawn, or they don't destroy us, is because they have no interest in doing either scenario. The group believes that they want to maintain the planet and the population as it is. They consider us, or they consider the Earth to be a farm and the human race to be cattle. And they want us actually to continue as we are, to grow and thrive, because according to the group, they harvest our souls upon death for like a poorly understood energy derived from the human life force, i.e. the soul. And to get to your point about why they hated us so much, it was partly because they were so reliant on us for their food source, if you like. In simplistic terms, a food source, it was they hated us, but they were so reliant on us, so they hated us even more.
That's some very strange stuff. Well, look,
I'd be the first to admit that's a very strange story.
We're going to take a quick break, Nick, so if you hold on for just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Dark Matters Radio. Tonight, my guest, Mr. Nick Redfern, where we are discussing his brand new book, just published, just released, Final Events and the Secret Government Group on Demonic UFOs and the Afterlife. We've got a lot more to talk about, believe me, so stick around. We'll be back after this.
It is Tuesday morning, the 11th of September.
We will never forget.
We got plane crashed into the World Trade Center.
Plane crashed into the Pentagon.
United 93 call.
We witnessed a second airplane.
September the 11th, 2001.
We're on 71. We're coming up behind you.
The two towers, the Pentagon, like 93.
There are times in our lives that are life-changing. This appears certainly to be one of them.
Join President Barack.
Barack Obama in his weekly radio address.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Our men and women in uniform stand watch abroad to each and every one of them, and to the families who bear the quiet burden of their absence. We honor your service. We are inspired by your sacrifice, and you have our unyielding support.
CyberStation USA brings it to the world on demand, exclusively on CyberStationUSA.com. CyberStation USA is the future of radio. Get your business into the online future at the world's largest internet radio station. From banner placement on our homepage to any of our broadcasters features, commercials on our video player, audio spots on any of our shows, or at the beginning of any of our on-demand broadcasts. CyberStation USA offers competitive rates with a worldwide reach, a fully integrated one-stop-shop social media broadcast platform. For more information, please contact our sales department at Cameo at CyberStationUSA.com.
Terrestrial radio is basically going to be supplanted by what's happening in technology. You're going to see in your automobiles internet receivers instead of radios. Our cell phones are going to become fundamentally our computers. We know 3D is coming. Download every film ever made in 4 minutes. We're going to have a dramatic increase someplace down the road. When you get your internet receiver, that gives you the entire world. I'm going to continue to grow with this technology 3 to 4 Eastern Time, noon to 1 Pacific Time on CyberStationUSA.com. I follow what's happening. It's remarkable. I'm learning it. It's amazing. Get to where you want to be in the changing technology.
This is Mike Siegel at CyberStationUSA.com. You're listening to the future of radio, and I love being here. Lots more to come.
The first online station to be syndicated on terrestrial radio.
And the message immediately.
Steve, I'm this is Matt.
My Lord, is that
I will
CyberStationUSA.com.
We are in complete control of the planet now.
I want to see greater things stay as they are.
Now, I got a question. Mm-hmm. This incredible story revolves around one purported group that was identified in the book as a group named the Collins Elite.
Mm.
Now, this group is, from what I derived from the story, kind of an offshoot of intelligence of CIA and perhaps military, is that correct?
Yeah, what basically kicked it all off, Don, was that we know for certain, this is a verifiable fact, that in the late 1940s, when Jack Parsons, because of his work with JPL and Aerojet, and also the Hughes Aircraft Company, he was actually granted a top secret clearance with access when it was warranted to Army, Air Force, and Navy files on rocket research, and he was getting very dissatisfied with the work he was doing, and got an offer to work for the government of Israel. And
well, that had to be after 48.
Yes, it was. Yeah, this was after 48. I mean, he was doing research. He had a top secret clearance. I mean, before that, his top secret clearance kicked off in something like about 44, and existed through 49 when it was actually withdrawn. But what happened was that when the State of Israel was established, he got this offer to work for them, and what he did, so a very stupid thing, was to actually take a number of classified documents from his office at work, make copies, and then present them to an Israeli representative in the US, essentially to demonstrate the sort of work he was doing and the work he could do for them. And of course, this raised red flags with the FBI and the Air Force and the Army intelligence organizations or branches when they found out. And a huge investigation of Parsons' background was initiated to see if it was just a stupid act on the part of someone who really did want to work for Israel, or was it part? Was he actually working for Israel as an espionage agent? That was the worry.
Well, that,
in the end, they concluded. Go on.
Yeah, I was going to say that's what immediately popped into my mind. But
yeah.
Then I thought a little more about it, Nick, and I thought about the Book of Revelations. I thought about prophecy. And if this guy were, in fact, tied up with Aleister Crowley, he was conducting these occult rituals in order to contact something from the great beyond. And might it have been conceivable that he was trying to make a position for himself in Israel to witness and perhaps assist in these prophetic happenings?
Well, actually, that's quite possible, Don, because he actually at one point claimed himself to be none other than the Antichrist, you know, and he actually did believe that. He believed he was, you know, he was the Antichrist. It was his role to sort of usher in what he called the era of Crowleyanity and, you know, I guess, rewire the world.
Oh, my God.
So that, you know, that was definitely, you know, on the minds of certain people, but initially, at least, the first concern was, you know, is he working for Israel, or did he just do something stupid? And in the end, what happened was that he got fired from Hughes Aircraft, he lost his top secret clearance, but the government was still kind of angry about the fact that they couldn't get rid of him completely because they realized, you know, he was someone who had a lot of worth in terms of his knowledge. And so they sort of quietly put up with him, let him do his own research and, you know, learned from the sort of things that he was working on, rocket research, etc. But what I was told, and this is where the unofficial part of the story surfaces, is that because the you had everybody like the FBI, the CIA, Navy, Army and Air Force Intelligence, and the security people at Hughes, all involved in this very deep investigation of Parsons to determine if he was an espionage agent for Israel, what happened was that the more they dug into Parsons' background into this area, of course, the more they found out about his, quote, other life, you know, with Crowley, etc. And the story I got was that it was these other aspects of the story that began to fascinate the people who were working on the espionage angle, and that even when the espionage side was over, they had developed and collected so much information on Parsons that was suggesting links between Parsons and people involved in the early years of the flying saucer subject in 47 and 48, people even like Kenneth Arnold and Ray Palmer, that they thought, well, is there some sort of tie-in? And so from 47 till the early 50s, when the group existed in sort of like a fluid state, or so I should say it didn't really exist, it was basically like, as one of the people described it to me, a bunch of people working in the intelligence world who would get up together, like for martinis after work in some bar in D.C., and talk about Parsons and everything that was going on. And then over time it developed to where there were people in government who felt this was an area that was worth looking into, like an alternative Project Blue Book. And so they were offered like a quasi-official organization, you know, with funding to look into this, but some of them still held other positions as well. You know, it was like something that they would turn their hand to.
Like a think tank.
In fact, that was the best way to describe it, as a think tank, rather than, you know, the National Security Agency, where you have a headquarters, you know, a static headquarters in one place. It was people getting together when there was new material.
So
but
this,
over time,
this,
it did seem to develop more into like a unified body.
So this became what was then called the Collins Elite.
Yes.
But it
started off like, just as I said, like an off-the-record type thing.
Right. Did you ever make a determination on where they came up with that name?
Yeah, that's actually in the book. That's a very strange story. It comes from allegedly, you know, I mean, and again, it's a sort of thing that I can't imagine anybody making up because it's such an obscure story, and how would you find out about it in the first place? But there's a little town in New York called Collins, and when the group was in its early years, they consulted a number of people, like experts in demonology, various religions, and not just Christianity, although that became the predominant belief system afterwards, but in all sorts of areas, people who have studied ancient Babylonian texts on demonology and all sorts of things. And one of the people they spoke with was a Quaker who came from this little town of Collins. Now, Collins, its only real distinction is at one time the town was noted for the fact that it had, for a little town with just a few thousand people, it actually had 8 factories that made cheese and nothing else.
Yeah.
And most people were actually employed in that business. And there was this sort of this inside joke in the group that this little Quaker from the little town of Collins, you know, he kind of felt a bit important, and they joked that he was the elite of Collins because everybody else was working in the cheese industry. And the idea was that they just took this name as like an inside joke. Well, you know, we'll call ourselves the Collins elite, you know. And again, it sounds bizarre, but it's the sort of thing, well, you know, somebody said to him, how would anybody even know to make up something so crazy? You know, it sounds crazy enough to be true, I guess.
Yeah. Well, there was one more name that absolutely jumped out from this incredible tale, and that's a name that is quite famous or even infamous today, L. Ron Hubbard, who was the founder of Scientology. Now, it's alleged in this book he got a lot of his ideas and what have you ultimately from Parsons and, I guess, as an aside, also from Crowley.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say he got his ideas as such, but he was certainly friends with Parsons.
Well, until he took off with $20,000 of Parsons and Parsons' girlfriend.
Yeah, the story was that L. Ron Hubbard became sort of very, very interested in Parsons' work in these so-called Babylon rituals, you know, essentially to try and conjure up a so-called elemental being. And the two became friends and spent a lot of time working together. People don't actually realize that, you know, the fact that, you know, that this went on in the sort of mid to late 1940s. And, you know, they worked together quite closely until they had this sort of flame up and parted company and went their separate ways. And, you know, the interesting thing is that this actually ties in with how the group learned that Parsons had actually met none other than Kenneth Arnold. And the way it worked was like this, that Parsons was good friends with Hubbard. Hubbard actually wrote a lot of well-received science fiction. He was well known to Ray Palmer, who was one of the biggest editors in the sci-fi publishing world at the time. And Ray Palmer was also the person who co-wrote and published Kenneth Arnold's book, The Coming of the Saucers. And it was reportedly via Palmer to Hubbard to Parsons that Parsons became known to Arnold. And the Collins elite in its early incarnation, as they admitted to me, you know, they were just picking up on threads like this, the fact that Parsons, you know, was deeply influenced by Crowley, who had conjured up this alien-like entity. Then they found out that Parsons was linked tangentially with Arnold, the man who arguably ushered in, you know, the entire UFO puzzle. And on top of that, they found out that one of Parsons' colleagues, or certainly not a friend, Robert Goddard, another rocket pioneer, actually moved his base of operations to none other than Roswell, New Mexico. So they were looking at all these things linking Parsons with different aspects of the whole UFO subject.
This is an incredible spider's web.
Oh, it is. But the weird thing is that the fact that you know, Goddard moved to Roswell and that Parsons, you know, was linked with Hubbard and through him, through Palmer, etc., is all verifiable. you know, that's what kind of makes it interesting. But, you know, it is a highly convoluted and very, very strange story with so many twists and turns to it.
Well, you know, one part of the story that, for some reason, Nick, really resonated with me was the what turned out to be the debris field in Roswell after the after the alleged crash of a flying saucer. That there were people who claimed that their theory about this material, both meteorological, biological, all the material that's alleged to have been there may have been deliberately deposited there by these entities. Now, somebody started doing some test experiments and briefly was able to duplicate some of that?
Yeah, this is where it gets very, very strange. This is the one area of the book that's totally different to the rest of the book, because most of the rest of the book, if not all of the rest of the book, really you can argue that the conclusions of the group were solely and purely based around opinions and belief systems. You know, you could just as argue just as well that, yes, Parsons conjured these entities up, but he opened a portal to literal aliens or time travelers or interdimensional entities. It was just the conclusion of the group that, you know, it was their belief system that they went in the demonic direction. But the one piece that you're talking about is the one bit in the book that, if it's not disinformation, if it's not lies, if it's not a hoaxed document, suggests that there's something to support the idea that Parsons did open a doorway. And according to this particular report, this extensive report known as the Collins Report, which, when you read the select portions that have been made available, it's quite clear that it was never really intended for widespread circulation. It was more something along the lines of a document, sort of a briefing, bringing material and information up to date for the members of the group and those who would require, you know, the ability or the access to read it, etc. But it mentions in there about how supposedly using something known as the so-called Parsons technique, that research had been undertaken at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, exactly by who, we're not sure, where they reportedly, using whatever this technique was, spontaneously, albeit briefly, conjured up materials very similar to that found out in the deserts at Roswell. Now, when we say conjured up, we literally mean spontaneously appeared in the lab for a brief period before vanishing again to nobody really knew where from and where to. So, you know, this again pushes it down a sort of a very, you know, very, very strange area. But you're quite right. Their conclusion was that the, and actually this wasn't just a conclusion of the group as the story's related to me. This was actually also told to Ray Boucher by his people, namely the fact that they concluded that the debris, had essentially this material, had been, I guess, essentially woven or weaved, if you like, in a form of demonic alchemy. And the idea was to carefully spread it over the desert floor, not a crash or an accident, but again to lull us into the viewpoint of benign, albeit not entirely, you know, accident, or accident, I should say, they were, you know, accident-prone entities. They were as, I guess, you know, as fallible as we are. And that was the story that, as to how, you know, this all kicked off. And, of course, there was some other strange stuff as well relative to this as well, one being the so-called bodies found at Roswell. Now, unlike pretty much every other scenario as it relates to bodies found at Roswell, the group, in all their documents, there's never any mention of alien bodies. What they talk about is unusual biological materials, almost as one of the people described it to me, as like an extraterrestrial jackalope, where you have a creature that's made up, you see these at circuses and carnivals, where it's made up of real body parts, but it's a combination of different things to create like a faked entity. Now, what's sort of weird is that one of Jack Parsons' colleagues, a man named Theodore von Karman, who was, again, was a a renowned expert, legendary character in the field of rocketry, and who became a father figure to Parsons. He reputedly had an ancestor centuries ago who gave life to a golem, one of these legendary creatures, you know, from mythology.
In Prague, yes.
Yeah, exactly, in Prague. And also, on the day he died, Jack Parsons was supposedly, he was actually blown up in his lab, but on the day he died, he was supposedly trying to conjure up a creature known as a homunculus, which the literal description is a little man that possesses special magical powers. That's the best way to describe it. So in other words, you had Parsons and von Karman all having links to trying to create animate or quasi-animate entities out of inanimate matter, and that's precisely what the group concluded these entities were at Roswell, that they were like almost like DNA-based dolls or something along those lines, again, to, you know, hoaxes that never actually had life themselves, but were used to, again, try and deceive us. But we're not talking about, you know, stitching an arm on a leg and something like that, but almost like something that had been manipulated at the genetic level so it actually looked like real extraterrestrial biological material, if you like.
Yeah, that the story about the golem, I found that fascinating. I was aware of that, and there are people, I guess, within the mystical and occult aspect of the Jewish Kabbalah that believe that was a real occurrence, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are people who believe in this story, you know, absolutely with 100% certainty. And there are people who think it's just an entertaining story, you know, the equivalent of Santa Claus or something like that. I think, from my perspective, what I find fascinating is that regardless of how much stock people put into these stories about, you know, the homunculus and the golem, etc., the fact is that people like Parsons and von Karman were tied to these legends. That is a matter of fact, that it was one of von Karman's ancestors who was dabbling in this, and it is a fact that Parsons was trying to conjure up one of these little diminutive, magically powered entities on the day he died.
Now, I'm sorry, Nick, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that, so it does make it very, very strange, you know, regardless of what people conclude about it.
Okay, now, you also, during the course of this investigation and the research you conducted, and incidentally, allow me to applaud, you did a hell of a job here.
Well, thanks.
You actually had meetings with several former members of this group?
Yeah, these are sort of very, very similar to Ray's meetings. Sort of.
How did you manage that?
Well, what happened was that when Ray related this story initially to me, which was in 2006, and I did sort of like a brief, well, I said brief, we actually had a good long phone chat, but then Ray agreed that he'd be happy when I told him, you know, this sounds like a great story to follow up, and, you know, who knows, there could be a book in it somewhere. He agreed to an extensive interview. Now, as I mentioned in the book, you know, Ray was very happy to talk about all the complexities of what the people told him, where they met, pretty much everything he could remember. There were a couple of things he asked me not to publish, and I actually mentioned this in the book. I don't mention what the things were, but I do mention that, you know, he said, I'd rather you left several things out. And one of them, which was a key aspect of this scenario you're talking about, was the means and the wherefores, etc., as to how the initial meetings were set up and how they tracked him down and why they approached him. And when Ray related this aspect of the story to me, without sort of compromising, you know, my agreement to Ray, when he related it to me, there was enough leads, places, locations, names, etc., that I could go looking, you know, by using Google People Search and things like this and locations, and I'd start looking for the people that may have led these two scientists to Ray. And it basically developed that way, that, you know, it wasn't a case of me saying, you know, putting a dot on a map and then pinning a map and saying, I'm going to, you know, look here. That would just be absurd. It was only and literally because Ray's people had been directed to him by other people, and it was by tracking down these other people that it sort of set me on the trail. And, you know, I freely admit in the book that the meetings were sort of very sort of cloak and dagger, and although I got names of the interviewees, you know, one made a joke when I said, you know, is that your real name? And he kind of made a joke, well, it is this week. You know, it's kind of like, and that's why I put that in the book, because I didn't want to leave out what sounded like a small aside, but which could be integral parts of the story. You know, I wanted to sort of tell it all, and the fact that somebody makes an off-the-cuff comment like that, even in a joking fashion, you know, it's important enough, I think, not to leave it out. You know, maybe it's not a joke, you know. And so it really was a case of being sort of thrust into a bit of a strange, I won't say unnerving, because it wasn't, I'm not sort of that sort of character, but it was like a strange, surreal situation to be sat opposite someone, you know, in their 70s or 80s.
Right, well, now, when I was a police officer and I was investigating something, and I'm sure with all the years that you have now in what you've been doing, one gets a sense when you're talking to somebody, whether they're being straight with you, whether they're couching something, whether they're hiding something, or whether they're trying to BS you. What was your sense when you talked?
Well, I mean, the opinion I got from the people I spoke to, now bear in mind, altogether I think I spoke to 12 people. Of those 12, I think 7 agreed to be quoted in the book. 5 just would not speak on the record at all, or even off the record, but were willing to help in terms of leads and information. Now, of the ones that I met, my personal opinion is that they earnestly and honestly believed the conclusion they came to was correct. And I also believe that they did hold the positions in this group they claimed to hold, and that the group did exist in the way they claimed it to exist. And I think, you know, when I sat opposite these people, it wasn't like they were, you know, telling me everything under the sun and, you know, telling me entire aspects of the whole story, etc. It was purely, or not purely, but mainly from their own perspectives of their own piece of work. For example, one of the people I interviewed, a man named Richard Duke, he left the group in, I think it was 1960, and he said, well, you know, I really don't know too much about what's gone on after that. Now, you know, you could argue somebody was spinning a story with a view to spreading BS to hide another UFO scenario, then, you know, he might actually want to, you know, fill me full of stuff that happened in the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, but he didn't. He just said, well, I'm sorry, you know, I just don't know that much after 1960, which to me smacks more of somebody being honest, you know, because they're not trying to fill in every gap and, you know, conveniently tell you everything you want to hear. And, you know, it actually took over the course of several years to get all the information together. I think the first interview was like 2006. The last one was towards the end of last year, you know, so it wasn't like, let's get it all to him within 3 months or whatever, or 2 months, you know, it was spread out.
Well, dealing with this type of activity, one would expect to hear occasional anecdotes about negative consequences of dealing with this. Did you come across that?
Oh, yeah, I mean, this guy Duke, He told me some interesting things about how, for example, in the early years when the whole Space Brother contactee mystery was at its height, that this was one of the areas they focused on because for several reasons. One being that George Adamski, and I'll come to the whole negative thing. This is what I'm just building up to.
Okay, now let me also caution you, Nick, that we've got about roughly less than a minute and a half before we got to go to break.
Oh, okay. Well,
if you can't finish it, we'll pick it up when we come back.
Okay, that sounds fine. But yeah, I mean, just before we get to the break, there's several things I can talk about where even the people in the group were very sort of distrustful of not the group. They weren't distrustful of the group. They were distrustful and worried about the way the phenomenon was allegedly affecting the members, as if it had got its grips into the membership somehow and was trying to, I guess, divide them. You know, it realized the phenomenon, in other words, the demonic phenomenon, realized it had been, I guess,
observed
for what it is. Yeah, observed and realized for what it was, from their perspective at least. So.
They were looking at it, and suddenly they realized it might be looking back.
Yes, because it had been rumbled, if you like. You know, its cover had been blown. That's how the group viewed it.
Okay, well, we're going to have to take a break, Nick, so let's hold off there. You are listening to Dark Matters Radio. Tonight, my guest, Mr. Nick Redfern, where we're discussing his brand new book, Final Events. And I got to tell you, I found it a very disturbing, but I will also add, very important read, trying to take a look at this incredibly confusing subject. Hey, when we get back, a whole lot more, including I'm going to open the telephones up here before too long. So in the meantime, stick around, because like I say, we got a lot more coming.
Far from the city, there is a hangar. Better stay away from them, if someone's watching any move you make. Suddenly a siren rips through the midnight air. We see their black projects and strange behavior. Possible denials, top matters hiding there. UFOs tonight, in the skies of Phoenix. No one believes their lying eyes. We want those top matters brought into the light of day. All we want is freedom from top matters by old heart. Top matters. Government on the show with outlandish explanations. Ask yourself, do you want to know about three objects in the air? Are they real? Have you seen them? Tell us what you really know. The truth is out there. Far from the city, hangar doors are open. Take a look, we're watching you. Gravity's defying. In the sky there's something flying. Accelerating faster than the laws we know.
Complex after the Roswell crash was immediately put into place. All the generals and admirals and advisors and scientists were contacted and ordered to proceed to base in Colorado, where they were driven, picked up, and driven to the crash site.
About three objects in the air. Are they real? We know they're real. We've just seen them. Here to tell us what you know. The truth is out there. In the desert, far from the city, there is a hangar. Better stay away from there. If someone's watching any move you make. Suddenly a siren rips through the midnight. We see them black projects and strange behavior. Possible denials, top man is hiding there. You know tonight, in the skies of Phoenix. No one believes it, believes their lying eyes. We want those top masses brought into the light of day. All we want is freedom from top man is my own mind. Top masses, go.
You have to have a lot of patience if you're going to do something really hard.
We're on something here.
Now it's going to pay off for us.
There is definitely a technology generation.
This is affecting all of us.
I love the possibilities of a digital life.
Hello, just going to snuck up on us.
Allowing us to evolve into better people.
It's affecting all of us.
To rewrite the rules of interaction between human beings.
Amazing.
Terrestrial radio is basically going to be supplanted by what's happening in technology. You're going to see in your automobiles internet receivers instead of radios. Our cell phones are going to become fundamentally our computers. We know 3D is coming.
Download every film ever made in 4 minutes.
We're going to have a dramatic increase someplace down the road. When you get your internet receiver, that gives you the entire world. I'm going to continue to grow with this technology 3 to 4 Eastern Time, noon to 1 Pacific Time on CyberStationUSA.com. I follow what's happening. It's remarkable. I'm learning. It's amazing. Get to where you want to be in the changing technology.
This is Mike Siegel at CyberStationUSA.com. You're listening to the future of radio, and I love being here. Lots more to come.
This is Hans Steinberger of Dark Matters Radio, heard exclusively on CyberStation USA.
At a laboratory in Massachusetts, an FBI wanted poster arrives from headquarters.
What is a counterintelligence specialist with the FBI?
I did various sorts of surveillance, both physical and electronic related.
What, you didn't get to carry a piece?
No, I did not.
That's no fun!
They get a tip.
Only special agents carry the firearm.
Well, I worked 2 years undercover when I was a police officer. And let me tell you what, I never went anywhere, including got my 45, and that's on
I believe. There was one day.
Listen, they don't want you to hear on CyberStationUSA.com.
Due to the nature of the work, the public only knows so much.
It is a pleasure to have you right here with Dark Matters Radio.
I have no idea where it was from. I just know that your life is never, ever the same.
I mean, it is. It just happened yesterday.
CyberStationUSA.
You're thinking, what in the world was it? What was it? And where it came from? When it came from? We do not know.
It still takes people wearing headphones and listening in.
The moment had arrived.
And we're trying to get CyberStationUSA.
Our home.
Oh yeah, nothing like a little X-Files to set the mood for this show.
We are back. Break. Nick, we are back. You can really play this game.
Here's something, Nick, that kept going through my mind the entire time I was reading Final Events. This all appears that it is connected through psychic means in one level or another, right?
Correct, yes.
I thought all the way back to the late 60s, the very early 70s, at Stanford Research, when people like Targ and Putoff and those guys were working with Ingo Swann, that later became what today collectively is known as the remote viewing program, the Stargate Project. Yeah. And suddenly I thought to myself, my God, if this is correct, if this story is not gigantic globs of disinformation, then what does that say about what they were doing for 20 years in the DIA, the CIA, and what have you with this?
Well, you know, I mean, the important thing that I've stressed to people, and, you know, I point out in the book, is that this was a belief system of this particular think tank group.
Right.
Now, you know, I think people who are interested in UFOs are people first. You know, we're UFO researchers second. And, of course, people have beliefs and opinions. And, you know, it doesn't surprise me that this group existed at the same time that, you know, we had the remote viewing projects going on, in the same way that it existed at the same time Project Blue Book was analyzing pilot reports and radar reports. So in other words, you know, it's very much a belief-driven story, in the same way that, you know, there were people in the Air Force in the 50s who earnestly believed UFOs were evidence that extraterrestrials were amongst us. We know from some documents from the late 40s that one of the early theories looked at was, you know, is this something the Russians are flying around? So, you know, I don't think any of the conclusions that whichever group concluded actually has a bearing on what somebody else was doing, because we're still grasping for answers. So it is all very much belief-driven anyway, I think.
Well, yeah, it certainly is.
I mean, there's a phenomenon, but it's belief-driven as to what it is. That's the important thing.
Exactly, yes. Well, you know, then there are people like Valet, like Keel, who have for a very long time maintained that they did not feel that this was necessarily totally extraterrestrial. People like Imbrogno with his work on the djinn, people like Chris O'Brien with his work on the trickster phenomena. But it all seems to be the same phenomena that we're all trying to grasp and understand.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, you know, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that there's a phenomenon. And the one area that I do agree on with the Collins elite, you know, I'm not a particularly religious person, but I don't mind, you know, what if people hold religious beliefs. The one area I do totally agree with them on, though, however, is this issue that the phenomenon kind of behaves in a deceptive manner. And I think there's a lot to be said for the notion that the whatever the intelligence is behind the UFO mystery, it's been with us for a long time. And it may actually have the ability even to sort of change its motif and its appearance to, I guess, you know, accommodate the people of the particular time period. And this is something, again, that people like Valet have talked about, the whole messages of deception thing, where the phenomenon can manipulate the psyche for, you know, good or bad purposes. So I do believe that's correct. And I, for a long time, have sort of come round more to the idea that although there's a real phenomenon, it may not be extraterrestrial. You know, when you look at things today like quantum physics, it may be something that would even allow for something like this to be at work, where we're looking at a phenomenon that's, you know, from a different dimension rather than literally traveling from point A to point B, if you like.
Well, sure, absolutely. But regardless of how you slice it, this phenomenon, no pun intended, is about as alien as it gets.
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's no doubt it's definitively alien in the sense that it's unknown and it's from somewhere else. I don't have any doubts about that at all. I think the big question is, you know, who's right? You know, whose theory is the correct one? We know there's something going on. But,
well,
and all the theories can't be correct, but one of them has to be, I think.
Now, during all your research, now, this is a question that came into my inbox from Ryan in Washington. He has a name that he wants to bounce off of you.
Okay.
He said, what about Michael Aquino and Mind War? Did you encounter any stories about him?
No, I actually didn't. But the main reason, you know, I guess I could have included something like that, but the main reason I didn't was because it became clear to me that there were several tiers and levels within the government who knew strands of this story or who had involvement. And I sort of used data from those groups and where I could, you know, for example, where it references these experiments with the so-called Roswell memory metal, which actually wasn't part of the Collins elite group. It wasn't part of their work, but they got to hear about it, and this group shared data with them. So in other words, this was primarily the story of this one particular group. I mean, I could have included, you know, countless of other examples of where there'd been official dabbling in the world of the occult, but it would have been tangential and possibly not exactly sort of right on target with the subject matter of the book. You know, and it was literally a case of having to draw the line somewhere of, you know, how much sort of semi or quasi-related stuff I put in there that wasn't directly connected with this group. So.
Well, I'll tell you what if I open up the phone lines?
Yeah, sure, that's fine.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to open the phone lines up, ladies and gentlemen. If you'd like to call in with any questions, comments, remarks, talk to Nick or myself, this is what you do. Give us a call at area code 818-381-4094. Once again, that is area code 818-381-4094. And as soon as this opens up, we'll have the phone lines ready to go. And this always takes a second. It's through Skype. So, okay. All right. I think we've got ignition. All right. So once again, 818-381-4094. Nick, near the end of the book is one of the most troubling things I came across, and I want to ask you about it. It would appear that, now, once again, I'm not sure if this came from within the Collins elite or whether this was from without, but there were even suggestions, although I don't know how they would ever hope to do this, to force the population of the United States to become fundamentalist Christians. And yes, when I read that, the first thought that popped into my mind, blood would run in the streets.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, if you look at some of the polls today, the number of people who literally, you know, take certain biblical accounts literally. You know, you only have to look at the whole teabagging thing that's going on. You know, some of the belief systems of the people.
Hang on just a second.
Right now.
Hi, this is Don. Who's this?
Oh, Don, this is John Ryan from Putnam, Connecticut. How are you this evening?
Well, very good, John. How about yourself?
Good to talk to you tonight. Well, normally I'm inspecting the insides of my eyelids at this hour, but they changed my medication this week.
Okay.
That's not a joke, by the way.
Okay. Well, I hope you're in good health.
I'm getting there. I'm getting there. I'm going to turn back into a human being any day now.
Did you have a question for Nick?
Yes, I did. Nick, it's good to talk to you. I've heard you for many years now, and I've read several of your books. You just do a marvelous job, sir.
Oh, well, thank you. Thanks, John.
And my maternal grandparents were both English. They were both born in London, and I was raised by them. The worst thing my grandmother ever said to me when she got angry with me was, "Stop behaving like an American. You weren't raised that way." So, but anyway, question for you. I know tonight's subject is really, even for you, it's offbeat. You know, it's just,
yes, it is.
it's out there, and I mean, yeah. How did you decide to do this? I mean, did you just stumble onto it? Did you accidentally have someone tell you about it and decided to do more? I mean, it's not the kind of thing that you'd like your books about monster hunting and your books about UFOs and, you know, that kind of thing. Mm. I mean, at least that's a subject you can say, ooh, that's something I could write a book about. I mean, how did you decide to write a book about this?
Well, basically, it came from an Anglican priest named Ray Beauchesne, who's in Lincoln, Nebraska, and he was given the story initially by two scientists from the Department of Defense who approached him in 1991. And Ray related this story to me a few years ago about how literally, you know, like almost like DOD whistleblowers, like deep throat type sources who said, you know, we've been engaged in this project to contact what initially we believe were aliens, we now believe have demonic origins. And he related enough of the story to me when I spoke to Ray and did an extensive interview with him that it allowed me then to sort of go on the trail of this group. And then, you know, as in terms of deciding, you know, whether to do anything further with it, I mean, that was largely dictated by the amount of material that might conceivably surface. You know, had nothing else surfaced, it would have been perhaps an intriguing article in a magazine about Ray's experience and nothing else. As it turned out, you know, rather than race through it, I think it was early 2007 when I did the first extensive interview with Ray, and it's just been published. So, you know, we're talking getting on for 4 years between, I guess, starting to collect the information and research it to the present day. But, I mean, I'll be the first to admit, as you said, it is, by my standards, even quite offbeat. And that's why I've largely just told the story of the group. You know, I think it would have got very repetitive and tiresome to keep inserting my views and comments on every, you know, second paragraph or whatever. So I've just told the story as it was related to me, and, you know, as to how and why the group was formed and what they concluded and how and why they concluded
the thing. I have a speculative question, and I don't know whether you'd really be able to answer it, and that is, now that the book is out there and now that the story is out there, okay, and we see that's probably inevitably going to lead to other similar stories coming up, you know, other people surfacing, if you will, and maybe even relatives after they're dead, you know, yeah, surfacing, saying, I have a story and I have a story. What do you think the overall effect of your book is going to be, both in terms of getting more stories and in terms of even public policy? Do you think it's going to make any difference?
I mean, in terms of people coming forward, I mean, I've never written a book yet where it hasn't resulted in somebody saying, hey, you know, my grandfather knew about this, or, you know, he was stationed or she was stationed at this base and heard something about this case or incident. You know, I think every author gets that, whatever they're writing about.
Sure.
So I'm quite sure that's going to happen. Now, in terms of actually changing anything, unfortunately, I don't think it will have that much of an effect, because, you know, it's been my experience that UFO books very seldom sell outside of what is a relatively small community of book buyers. You know, some of the magazines, the most well-known ones, only sell a couple of thousand copies each because there aren't that many people buying them. And that's the same with UFO books. You know, it's for the most part, there have been exceptions, like Whitley Strieber's Communion and The Day After Roswell, the Corso book, Philip Corso book. They actually did sort of break out into the mainstream, but you often find that, well, for the most part, you find that doesn't happen. You know, most books, and mine included, you know, go under the radar and just sell to a small UFO research community. So, in other words, I think it'll be of interest to people in the UFO research community. And I think there are probably people on the inside who know about this project and allied projects who are going to follow the story quite deeply to see where it leads. I think the only time it would actually make a difference would be if it literally sort of blew, you know, the doors wide open on an aspect of this story that, you know, really brought something truly fantastic forward. Or on the other hand, you know, demonstrated that it was a complete disinformation ploy to hide the fact that aliens really did crash at Roswell, you know. I'm just not sure, but I think, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic that it's going to bring other people forward. To what extent it actually changes situations, or we just keep, you know, discussing UFOs for the next 50 years, I'm just not sure, you know. It's one of these issues. I think it could go either way, really.
So you don't see it making a big difference to the insiders, the guys who are in the intelligence community who might say, it's time to do something now.
Yeah, I think it may do. I mean, I actually think that this could have been part of the motivation of approaching Ray Beauchesne initially and then me taking this further, was to sort of test the waters with the theory as to see how people react. And I think from the people I spoke to, at least, I do believe that there are people on the inside that want the story out. And as several of them told me, it was such a controversial story, they didn't know how to get it out. It's like, how do you tell the world that we're the human race essentially are cattle being farmed of their souls by a demonic life force. You know, you cannot tell that story easily.
Some of it goes all the way back to Charles Fort, who said we're somebody's property. I mean, and he was saying that, what, in the 1920s?
Yeah, I mean, it is very, very similar, if not identical to that, John. It's, you know, it is that sort of scenario. And, you know, they told Ray, well, you know, how do we tell the story? And I think there's something to that, that if, you know, this group and people who are aware of it and allied projects are thinking they want to get it out, well, what's the best way to do it? You could argue the best way to do it is to give it to somebody who's going to write a UFO book, which is only going to sell, you know, a couple of thousand copies probably. But the important thing from their perspective is it's actually easy to keep a close watch on that group and see how the story develops and what people are saying at the blogs and, you know, the news groups and websites, etc. And then, you know, that's far easier to keep watch and tabs on than if, you know, you put the story out there and just chaos breaks out. And I think that's an important point. You know, people often say, well, why do whistleblowers approach the UFO community with these stories? And I think it's because the UFO community is small and it's easy to watch them and gauge the reaction, and then you can apply that on a larger scale. So I think that's what could have happened here. You know, I admit that's my speculation, it's just a theory, but I do think that's what's going on, that somebody wants the story out and let's see what happens if we put bits of it out and, you know, where it goes.
You could very well be onto the money there, Nick. Okay.
Absolutely. Well, John, thank you very much, gentlemen. It's been good to talk to you.
John, thank you for your call.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night. All right. And if you'd like to call in, once again, you can reach us by dialing area code 818-381-4094. Well, I'll tell you, this weekend, Nick, my Friday night co-host... hang on a minute. We got another call coming in. Hi, this is Don. Who's this?
Hi, Don and Nick. This is Ward calling in. How you guys doing tonight?
Ward, good evening. We're doing good. How about yourself?
Oh, I'm blown away. You guys are knocking my socks off. This is a great show tonight. I'm really enjoying you guys.
Well, thank you.
Now, you know, Nick, it's funny. I've been really waiting for this book. A couple of years ago, you had kind of hinted that you were doing something along these lines.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that you actually kind of made inways to find out about this stuff. So I'm really excited to get the book myself. So congratulations on a fantastic book.
Well, thank you.
What I wanted to ask you was, I had a couple of three questions here. Is one thing I'm a little confused about is when you were mentioning the Lamb character that Crowley supposedly conjured or came in contact with, and this group that kind of was keeping eyes on that sort of, you know, a concept. How did they make a linkage in the 40s or 50s to this Lamb character and sort of the extraterrestrial thing when the Greys kind of didn't really make inroads until Betty and Barney Hill? Or am I just not making the connection properly?
No, actually, no, that is a valid point. One of the ways, at least, was that the, you know, I mentioned this reference to the Roswell crash and the so-called biological materials as they were talking about. And the scenario was that they, although some people were saying these bodies were, you know, literal dead creatures, the group concluded they'd never lived in the first place. But the description of whatever they were, whether they were dead bodies or, as the group believed, they were like some sort of manipulated, you know, literally DNA being manipulated to construct something out of flesh, blood, etc., but that was never actually real, but that they were of the classic description of like small bodies and large heads. And it was this that made the connection with the Lamb story, the idea that it sounds very similar, the body sounded very similar to the description of Lamb. You know, you're quite right, talking in the 50s about the Greys, but they applied it to the body supposedly found at Roswell.
Some of these concepts seem very, actually very advanced. What was amazing, Nick, that you were talking about is that they keep making references that our souls are going to be harvested, and it sounds extremely similar to the kind of stuff that John Lear was, you know, talking about in the 80s that our that we're just a farm here and our souls were being harvested and that we're just containers and that, you know, that religion and laws were created to protect, you know, the possessions. But, you know, that doesn't scare me half as much, Nick, as that John Lear might have been telling the truth. That scares me.
Well, you know, I mean, it's interesting that if you, although, you know, the story certainly that I'm telling, you know, the Collins elite, that hasn't been told to this extent before, but there have been people who have sort of tied the whole UFO phenomenon and certain aspects of it, like alien abductions, to the human soul. For example, in several of John Mack's books, he talks about having interviewed abductees who said that they felt these entities were literally trying to steal their soul. Now, Strieber also made connections between the human soul and abductions, and a very controversial character as well, Bob Lazar, you know, who has as many believers as detractors. Even he said, you know, he read this or was exposed to this classified document on religion that talked again about these so-called containers, and he speculated, you know, maybe containers of souls and how important it was for these entities that the souls are maintained. Now, granted, the people I spoke to admitted that their conclusions on this sort of farm harvesting of souls scenario was based around speaking to people who'd had near-death experiences and had uncovered certain things during abduction experiences that led them to conclude this. You know, there was literally, of course, no way that they, you know, could go to wherever this was going on. But they told some very strange stories about almost like things in the Matrix where you have all these, you know, human bodies in pods going on endlessly. They talked about so-called soul factories where, you know, people had come back, been brought back, resuscitated, and having seen this endless soul factories with these entities kind of just feeding on whatever this human life force is in almost like a vampire-like fashion, I guess.
Oh, it's terrible.
You know, the big question is whether it's just, you know, whether it's subconscious belief systems and, you know, hallucinations at the moment of death, or is there something to it? I mean, some of the group as well, I didn't get into this too much in the book because I didn't get enough material on it, but I do know that some of the people in the group concluded that they didn't actually conclude that this phenomenon was demonic, but they did conclude that the scenario possibly was correct of interdimensional entities feeding on the human life force, but it didn't necessarily have to be connected with religion or demonic entities. It could just literally be a poorly understood life form that harvests or feeds in a different way to us.
This is really an extraordinary book. I think it's going to make bigger inways than you think, because
I don't want to come across being pessimistic that it's not going to have any effect. I hope it does. It's because it's such a strange story, where even I've never sort of gone down this path before, it's kind of like uncharted waters as to where it might go and might not go, I think. That's a point I'm sort of trying to get across, not to be pessimistic about its effect. I have no way to gauge it because I've not done anything like this before, I guess.
Well, Nick, I can't tell you. You're one of the few people in this field that does have credibility, and I do have an extensive collection on, you know, UFOs and ufology, and there's only a hand, literally on one hand you can count the whole, you know, UFO satanic connection. I think one of the first books was the Omega Conspiracy, and some of these books were really just poor. I mean, they did not prove their, you know, they were just sort of talking points and trying to push off their, you know, belief systems. But I think your book's going to make more inways than you think.
Oh, well, thank you. We'll see what happens.
Now, this whole connection between like Parsons and Crowley and Hubbard and was, if I'm remembering right, didn't Crowley wasn't one of those characters? I think it might have been Parsons, was really into the H.P. Lovecraft, Cthulhu mythology, and Crowley got really, you know, basically pissed off that he was into that whole thing and said, stop paying attention to the, you know, these stories and stuff. Did you come across anything connecting any of those characters to, like, the Lovecraftian mythology?
Not directly, only in the sense that a number of authors and researchers had made the connection that, you know, people like Lovecraft, particularly in his novels, had talked about these other realms and you know, that we could have, you know, these so-called old ones where we could open doorways and conjure them up. In other words, there was a parallel with what Parsons was supposedly doing in real life, but it was more of, you know, drawing the comparison and people saying, well, you know, does that mean Lovecraft actually knew some secret arcane teachings or whatever? But no, nobody actually ever said to me, you know, we had files on Lovecraft or anything like that, and we thought that was part of the story. No, that never cropped up, no.
Yeah, I just, fantastic show tonight, guys, and I really do think that that you found some, you know, that this group, not that their conclusions are valid, but that some of the concepts are very interesting, and I think there are tantalizing clues here that are hinting at something bigger than just ETs or even a trickster or crypto-terrestrial thing. I mean, I think we're taking this a step further that it just makes us think outside of the box, and anything that makes us think outside of this box within this field is a very good thing. So I want to thank you tonight, gentlemen.
Well, thank you, Ward.
Okay, have a good night.
Okay, you too.
Thank you, too.
And, okay, we got the phone is free, open again. If you'd like to contact us, give us a call, 818-381-4094. And what I started to say before Ward called in, Nick, was that my Friday night co-host, Rich Saraday, dropped out on Sunday. And we were discussing this book, and it turned into almost a three-hour talk fest.
Wow.
And we looked at a lot of angles and a lot of different aspects. And I got to tell you, as a matter of fact, I have a personal plea. If any of you guys in the intelligence agencies by chance happen to record that, I really wish you'd send me a tape of that three-hour chat, because I'd like to go through there and turn some of that into another radio show. So
I'm sure somebody's got it on tape somewhere.
Yeah, just on the off chance they might have it on tape. So what do you think ultimately, from everything I read in the book in Final Events, this group is still in business?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, as I point out in the book towards the end, I was told that most of the projects were in sort of closed status or even closed down. And that may have some bearing on why some of the people spoke out, because, you know, it's not overtly active anymore. The story I got was that they feel they've proven their point and that now it's just a case of getting ready for literally the final battle between good and evil, Armageddon, Judgment Day, everything else, you know.
Well, that kind of makes me curious on how they viewed September the 11th, 2001.
Oh, well, that actually features in the book, because they concluded that that was, I guess, like the commencement, the final countdown to
the battle.
Yeah. That was one of the areas they focused on. Now, this is where it gets highly controversial, because in the early years, and certainly through the 50s, 60s, 70s, and up until probably the early 80s, when the Reagan administration came in, they started to go down far more and more a fundamentalist path. Prior to that, there were people who concluded that the UFO phenomenon was occult-based and demonic, but it was a belief system, and they felt, you know, should we tell people or not? Certainly by the 90s, and definitely, as I was told, post 9/11, the group had been radically altered to the point where the people were full-on old-time fundamentalist believers who felt that, you know, everybody's soul was in jeopardy. And they came to a very weird conclusion, one being that the ability of these entities to exist in our world and interact with us was dependent upon our willingness or not to allow them in. In other words, you know, if you engage them, you're going to get what you ask for. If you can hold them at bay through, you know, the power or belief in religion, then, or the Christian religion, if you like, from their perspective, then you can actually hold them at bay. And the group's conclusion was, if the final battle's coming, then we need a nation of full-on believers, not just people who go to church on a Sunday, but people who are so fearful of the Christian God, and where over 10 or 15 years, we can, you know, indoctrinate the 5-year-olds to the, by the point they're 20, you know, they're just literally living in fear.
There's something chilling about that, Nick.
Yes, and the idea was that they felt that rewiring the U.S. population's mindset to this belief system, it was worth the sacrifice to put the country in pretty much like a lockdown, almost like a state surveillance, you know, type situation. It was worth it if it was going to save the souls of the population. They viewed it along those lines. And some of them didn't even view it as a sacrifice. They felt that this is the future, that that's the way the country needs to be, and it's convenient that the end's coming because it gives us the chance to you know, put it in place and save everybody's souls. which is, you know, it's almost like a religious fascism, which, as I said earlier, I don't care what people believe from a religious perspective, but when you try and hijack it as a means to outright control people through fear, then, you know, that's overstepping the mark.
Well, it would be no different than Saudi Arabia, Iran, or any of those. Mm-hmm.
No, you're right. It's just you don't expect it in the Western world to people to actually go that far. But, I mean, you know, there's absolutely no doubt. Now, whether it's the effect of the group or not, but there's absolutely no doubt that post 9/11, certainly the Bush administration was deeply influenced by, you know, religion. I mean, one thing, for example, is in 2003 when intelligence briefings on the war in Iraq were sent to the White House by the Pentagon. They were actually delivered with cover pages that didn't just have like a top secret stamp on them, but they quoted from the Book of Psalms and the Epistles of Peter. That's a fact. I mean, I actually have one of these that was released through the Freedom of Information Act. It's dated March 31, 2003. And the front cover, bear in mind this is an intelligence briefing on an aspect of the Iraqi war. The cover page reads, "Therefore, put on the full armor of God, so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground, and after you have done everything, to stand." So in other words, you know, instead of just getting intelligence briefings like during the Second World War or whatever about Hitler's movements, it was being interpreted within the White House or pushed as like a holy war almost, which, you know, it's, you have to wonder who's doing the pushing, you know.
I just had something I recalled. Do you remember several years ago that there was a mini brouhaha over a company here in the United States that manufactured optical sights for sniper rifles?
Yes.
And that they were shipping these out to the military, and that they had biblical passages inscribed on them. Do you recall that?
Yes, I do. They became known in the media as Jesus rifles.
Right.
But basically, yeah, they were sights.
Telescopic sight.
You can find this on the internet. You know, if you look up on the internet Jesus rifles, you know, you'll find this story as they became known, where they basically had messages, and some of the messages were actually taken from the end times dominated Book of Revelation, and that's a fact, and they were eventually withdrawn. But, you know, you did have them sent out. And this is like another example of where religion is playing more and more of a dominant role within the realm of the U.S. military. Now, you know, that didn't happen in the Second World War or the First or the Vietnam War. So why is it now that there is this need or desire on someone's part to instill religion in the U.S. military when that has never been done before to this extent?
Well, perhaps in part it's in part because of who we're currently fighting.
Well, I mean, you could argue that, but then again, you know, why? Because they have this particular belief system, you know, whether it's, you know, whatever belief system, that doesn't necessarily mean that in instilling a Christian belief system allows those troops to succeed any more or any less.
Sure.
That's what I don't understand. Is somebody or people, I should say, you know, are pushing a more of a religious agenda. I mean, it's like I was talking to somebody the other day, me originally coming from England. One of the things I always find sometimes kind of amusing, but it's disturbing as well, is that when, you know, when the elections come up for, you know, when you're electing a new president over here or prime minister in Britain, one of the most glaring differences is that when you see in England, the prospective prime ministers being interviewed and, you know, lobbying and telling people what they can do for the country, you know, if you elect them, religion never comes into it. Nobody cares about the religious beliefs of the prime minister. But over here, it's almost like the people who are running for president have to say, oh, yeah, I'm Christian, I go to church every Sunday. But, you know, it doesn't help to balance the budget or, you know, protect the economy if you happen to believe in life after death. It should, you know, and that's the way it is in England. Nobody cares if you believe in life after death, if you're going to be prime minister. They want to know what you're going to do about inflation and wages and unemployment and healthcare or whatever. But it seems, but I know looking back in history, you know, that religion and government were separate, you know, in the Kennedy years or Eisenhower or whatever. But today, you know, you better be a Christian and you better tell everybody if you want to run for president. You know, and
well, we have just two more years before we're in the middle of that. Actually, it'll probably start in about 4 to 6 mm-hmm. months. Nick, we got to take our last break. So if you would hold on for just a moment.
Sure.
This is Dark Matters Radio. My guest this evening, Mr. Nicholas Redfern, his book, Final Events. If you'd like to find out more about it, if you haven't yet seen a copy of it, you can go up to the darkmattersradio.com website. And there are links, and the cover of the book is up there. And, of course, it's available all over Amazon. Stick around. We'll be back to finish this out.
The new revolution in radio.
CyberStationUSA.com.
Americans are united in sending one message.
We will lead with this matter.
I will do my best to represent my nation.
We have an extra
mouth.
Really looking good.
This is the evolution of radio.
You're more integrated now than at any other point in the history of the human race.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, the 44th president.
And our confidence shaken. Though we are living through difficult and uncertain times, I want every American to know this. We will rebuild. We will recover. And the United States of America will emerge stronger than before. In the imagination of our entrepreneurs and the pride of the hardest working people on earth, those qualities that have made America the greatest force of progress and prosperity in human history, we still possess in ample measure. What is required now is for this country to pull together, confront boldly the challenges we face, and take responsibility for our future once more. With plans on this scale comes enormous responsibility to get it right. That's why I've asked to lead a tough, unprecedented oversight effort.
My journey officially began on January 14th, 2005. I'm not a radio show host. My name is Stephen Pesevich. I'm simply a father. Life doesn't have to be picture perfect in order to be experienced as the most magnificent journey. My daughter had what was described by her doctor as the largest tumor that he had ever seen in a two-month-old infant. For me to reach out to those who are struggling, MyDadsDiary@gmail.com. Spread a message of hope by sharing experiences.
CyberStation USA is the future of radio. Get your business into the online future at the world's largest internet radio station. From banner placement on our homepage to any of our broadcaster stations, commercials on our video player, audio spots on any of our shows, or at the beginning of any of our on-demand broadcasts. CyberStation USA offers competitive rates with a worldwide reach. A fully integrated one-stop-shop social media broadcast platform. For more information, please contact our sales department at Cameo at CyberStationUSA.com.
This is the future of radio. CyberStationUSA.com.
Back, Nick. Suddenly, the damn phones just exploded.
Hey, Don, I'm here.
Yeah, I know, Rich, and I got two more calls coming in. Yeah,
my internet is out. I haven't been able to listen to the show. The internet is out in my house.
Oh, it is. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yes, that's the only way I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Well, look, I got other calls coming, buddy.
Okay. So send me the show.
You got it.
All right.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi, this is Don. Who's this?
Don, this is John Ryan again. I just wanted to add something. I may have misspoken earlier when I had called. I thought about what you and Nick had said just before the last break, and this might actually become a mainstream political issue. It might. I mean, think about it. You know, you have people on both sides of this who could say, well, of course, naturally that's what they're doing. And you have people on the other side saying, well, that's terrible that folks would do this. I mean, you know, that you might actually have a breakout on your hands.
Well, I think that could happen. I think where if it does happen, I think it could possibly stem from the fact that a lot of people might consider the whole controversial angle of secret government funding being applied to a project, you know, to essentially study demonology, you know, deep inside the government. So I think that in itself could be a breakout story, and then it could, you know, I guess expand from there. So I think if it does happen, I think it'll be because of that. People will be, you know, asking questions, why is the government essentially funding demonology.
Right. John, I want to thank you for calling back in, but I've got some other calls I've got to get to.
Absolutely. Thank you, gentlemen.
You betcha. All right. Let me get this answered here. Hi, this is Don. Who's this?
Yeah, this is West of the Rockies?
Yeah, this is West of the Rockies. Is this Ryan?
This is Ryan.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Question for Nick.
Go ahead.
Hey, Ryan.
Nick, the title of your book is Final Events. Mm-hmm. So the question is where'd you come up with the title for? Is there a final ending to all this stuff? Or?
Well, basically, the title itself was the work of the publisher, but the reason they came up with that was because it does tie in with the conclusions of this group. The group basically came to the conclusion that the flying saucer phenomenon, when it began in 1947 with Kenneth Arnold, was like the last, in their view at least, like demonic deception before the final battle between good and evil, which they believe is now sort of looming on the horizon. And they concluded that the whole 9/11 thing was sort of the real countdown towards, you know, this literal final battle. So in other words, the final events is what the group believes the UFO subject will be, you know, its ultimate outcome has been to deceive us for however many years into like an extraterrestrial deception, and then we'll have the final event, which will be, you know, the fulfillment of ancient prophecies, etc. But of course,
well,
that's their belief.
I have a little bit of a different view, but I, you know, it's very interesting. I tend to think that there's a good and bad. There's good around and there's bad around, and I think that's my personal view. I mean, is there any documents to it?
It's kind of what they also concluded. You know, that everything wasn't bad. It wasn't just us against this evil force. They felt that, you know, there was a good force as well. You know, so. It wasn't like a
war. Yeah, I hate to agree with John Lear. I like Ward. I'm scared that I might agree with John Lear about something. But maybe that's what we're looking at is, maybe this planet is some sort of place where we're kind of stuck here until, we're sort of like Stanton Freeman or whatever's cosmic Watergate, where we're kind of contained here. And whoever's out there not letting us go further out, because if you look around, there's sure a lot of people that don't have their heads screwed on right on this planet. And if you let all the people that you see day to day they don't have their heads screwed on right, maybe they don't want us out there yet. You know what I mean?
That's a good point.
Okay, well,
I don't
show
care.
That.
If I get the opportunity,
I'll get your book there.
If I get the opportunity, thanks. I'm going out there, Ryan. I don't care if they're ready or not.
I know, but what I'm saying is that maybe that's what we're looking at is this is some sort of starting point for life, you know. But yeah, you know, there's dark forces, but you know, there's a lot of good in people too, and I think Dick's onto something here, and I hope this book picks up steam, and it's an interesting story because I've never heard of it before.
Okay.
Yeah, this whole thing. Nick, you seem to come up with new things, new ideas and new thoughts that nobody else has really looked into, and that's what I like about your work.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot.
You don't get those through the Ouija board, do you, Nick?
No ideas? No, I mean, you know, in fairness, there are some, you know, there's some stories that I've investigated that start great and that I think still would make great books. It's just that, you know, I just haven't been able to take them any further. I mean, a good example, it's sort of off topic, but I delved into a story a few years ago about when the military in Vietnam had a plan to exploit a lot of Vietnamese folklore stories of ancient creatures and monsters, and not dabbling in the occult, but just to sort of spread these tales as psychological warfare stories to you know, frighten the enemy. And they, you know, they were consulting ancient texts and books, not along the lines of this group, but, you know, just saying.
Do you know they did that in the Philippines?
Yeah, I know that one with Lansdale and the Hook.
The Hook,
as one vampire.
Right.
Yeah, but they were talking about doing it more in Vietnam. And I thought about doing a book on this at one point, but I just couldn't get enough material to fill a whole book. But there was no doubt it was going on. It was just, I just couldn't get enough corroborative material. That was all. So.
Oh, yeah, that the psychological warfare. Well, I'll tell you, that can be a very tricky beast. Okay, Ryan, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks, guys. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. Well, Nick, we are just about, believe it or not, out of time. As always, my friend, this has been fascinating.
Thanks for having me on, Don.
Oh, hey, always. This has been a fascinating thing. Do you have any last thoughts before I let you go?
Some people have read the book, as you mentioned, you know, being quite disturbed by it, and I would sort of, you know, just be aware that this is a conclusion of certain people in governments. You know, it's in the way that some people concluded UFOs are alien, and I wouldn't, you know, want people to think that the end is, you know, the end is definitely near. This is just a conclusion of one group. But I felt it was valid to put the story out because it was a government think tank that concluded this, and that makes it sort of pretty unique, and the fact that there are a lot of threads that, you know, run through the story that seem to make some sort of logical sense to a degree. So, you know, I hope people will look at it from that perspective, that I've just tried to tell a story of a group and what they concluded and how and why they concluded.
Well, here's a little something to keep in mind. As a matter of fact, when I was talking the other day, I'd kind of like to do a roundtable about some of this with Chris O'Brien, you, maybe Greg Bishop.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be one hell of a show.
No, I'd be quite happy to do that. I mean, sometimes that's a great way to do it, you know, where you just kind of shoot the breeze and just go where the conversation goes and, you know.
Absolutely.
It can be good. You can get a good heated argument and conversation going. It's, you know, it sort of stimulates things.
Amen, brother. Amen. Tomorrow.
With a good round table fight, so.
You betcha. Tomorrow, Adam Gorightly is going to be on. Not sure who that is. Adam Gorightly. We'll go up to the darkmattersradio.com website and read all about it. The who's who of the Charlie Manson family. Oh, yeah. That's it for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Keep your eyes to the sky, your ear to the ground, and we'll be back again tomorrow. Stay safe.